Hello, everybody. Welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. My guest this week is Carolyn Hennessy. You may have seen Carolyn on True Blood, Cougar Town, where you have a great role as an incredible sexual predator.
The only sexual predator, actually, on the show, after the first episode. But go ahead, okay. Keep going.
General Hospital.
Yeah.
Right, Emmy nomination for that. Every theatrical stage around Los Angeles, that's true.
Pretty much.
You've also written a New York Times best-selling Pandora series of children's books. You bake. You're an animal rescue activist. Right?
Advocate. Always have to, that's the first thing I have to kind of clarify. Advocate.
And you have your own podcast, which is called what?
It's called Animal Magnetism. And can be heard on www.ubnradio.com every other Sunday.
ubnradio.com.
Yeah.
All right, so there's lots of stuff we're going to talk about. We'll hear more about all that stuff in a moment.
Sure.
But first, I would like to say Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACS Digital TV. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is Carolyn Hennessy. Hello, Carolyn.
Hello, Denzel.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And if I'm given to understand correctly, I am the first. This is the sort of the cherry moment, as if you will. I mean, oh, you're blushing. I can tell you're blushing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's a little weird when brown people blush. You never.
But I can tell. Even this sort of, as you yourself said, ethnically ambiguous. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous, but ethnically ambiguous. I can still tell there's blushing going
there's
on.
Blushing.
But yeah, but this is the first. So I am happy and also honored that I get to sit here across from you for the first time.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
I hadn't thought about it as our cherry moment, but I think
that's why I go there.
You're right. That's
somebody had to.
Yeah, I think so. Before we start and get into stuff, I just want to say there's this little can here.
I was looking at the can.
Yeah, it's a coffee can, and it's a tilt jar. So at any point in the show, if you want to change the subject or not ask a question or answer a question, or if you just feel the whim, you can pull out from this coffee can the blue pieces of paper in here are locations, and the pink pieces of paper are lines of dialogue, and you can pick them out, and then we can just start fresh from right there.
Okay.
At any moment.
At any moment?
At any moment.
Like right now?
You could if you
okay,
want to.
Okay, but no, I don't want to. I think you've got a bit of a set, and I'm gonna go with it for just a few moments.
We're gonna see what is happening.
I'm gonna put this over close to me.
Yeah, you can put that close to you. And for listeners, we take audience suggestions. So if listeners email a location or a line of dialogue to Comedy Death Star @acsdigital.tv, we will put it in the tilt jar, and you're. Suggestion.
Okay, but these, since I'm the first one, we haven't gotten any from the audience yet, so these are just man off the street, people you've run into in restaurants.
The man off the street would be me. I wrote them. Mostly after midnight when I was supposed to be doing something else, and then all of a sudden a location or a line would pop in, and I would say, oh, that doesn't make any sense. Let's put that in the jar.
Okay.
It's kind of the opposite of when you're cursing, you put a penny or a dime in the jar.
Sure.
Anyway. My first question, I have an animal-related question.
Lay it on me.
Because I know that that's important to
lay
you.
It on me.
I recently saw something where people were saying that to discourage poaching, they are painting rhinoceros horns and elephant tusks hot pink.
Hot pink.
Does that make sense, really? Have you heard about that?
If the substance that they are using actually permeates deep enough into the elephant tusk, the rhinoceros horn, then yes, it does. Because that sort of, that pure creamy ivory, that's one of the things
that makes it
prized in certain culturally backward countries in terms of this issue. There are people on this earth who still believe that elephants were put on the earth simply to drop, that they simply dropped their tusks, and that they were put on the earth to give us their ivory. Naturally, that is, of course, culturally backward and incorrect. But that would be a brilliant way to discourage poaching, because it would ruin the ivory. Many people also don't know that A rhinoceros horn and an elephant tusk is like a giant fingernail. It will grow back. So there is, not that it should be taken in the first place. I'm not advocating that. But there's no need to actually slaughter the animal to take what isn't yours in the first place,
right.
But that, you know, you can get a lot of money for on the black market. So
right.
I think if it does work, I'd love to see elephants and rhinos running around with rainbow colors of ivory.
Well,
you know?
now that's another political issue, because then people who are against the gay agenda are going to say that you are turning these endangered animals gay by making them wear rainbow and hot pink tusks. I don't personally believe that. But.
And you know what? I fully support that.
The gay animals. Okay.
There are some animals that are hermaphroditic. There are some animals that that swing both ways, bat for both teams. I've never seen an elephant do it, but if somehow, some way, we could get propagation of elephants and rhinos if they simply ran around with multicolored tusks and were gay, I'd go, hey, I'll be out there with a paint can. I would go to Africa and Asia with a paint can. I would traverse the jungles of Thailand with a paint can.
I think so. Now we have a trip to do together.
Hey,
that's right up my alley, actually.
Yes, I think it is, because you have traveled. You are a world traveler.
Yeah, I've been a lot of places.
You've been a lot of places, yeah. Places that I haven't been. I think I've been a lot of places for your average bear.
Yes.
But you've been to actually one place where I wrote to them about 3 years ago and said I would never go, and it was always top number one on my list.
Which is
one? India.
You would never go to India.
Right.
Now.
Right.
Because.
You ready?
Yes.
In Uttarakhand, India, a province in India, there was tremendous encroachment on the leopard habitats. And in one particular town in Uttarakhand, a leopard encroached 3 times into the village and mauled, I don't think they killed, mauled either one or 2 people, one of which was a child, and I will not go into detail at all, but what the village did to this leopard was inexcusable. So I wrote, and there's video, and I wrote to the Ministry of Tourism, and I said, India has always been, for your majesty, for your history, for your deep, deep spirituality, the colors, the vibrance, the people. I said, it's always been number one on my list of places to go. And I said, and until the people who did this thing to this animal that was simply acting on instinct and was hungry and had cubs to feed, until those evildoers are and they know who they are brought to justice, I'm not coming. You might not care, but I ain't coming.
So it's a protest.
It's a protest. And then about a year ago, I heard that there was a tremendous rock slide, a huge, huge landslide in Uttarakhand, India. And I thought, well, karma's a bitch. Ain't karma a bitch? So
it's a big country.
It's a big country.
But,
yeah, I
know. I mean, these things happen
in
a lot of places.
Yeah, I know.
And it's not new.
I know.
So you're not going to. But we can.
We can go to Africa and Thailand. Believe me, I'll take you to Cambodia if you haven't been.
No, I have not been to any of those three places, and I'm interested in all three.
Thailand,
Africa trip. Only Morocco, which is Africa. But
it's not, you know.
Africa.
But everybody goes to Rick's.
Yeah.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
It's
so,
not Africa.
Yeah, that's right. It's not Africa. Not when you've got Ingrid Bergman looking the way she does.
It's like saying you went to Cuba and you went to America. I mean, it's
right.
Close, but it's not
right.
Really there.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I would still love to be able to go to India. And in my heart, I would love not to have a protest.
Yeah. Right.
So.
Well, maybe something will change your mind at some point.
Maybe you can help change my mind.
Well, it's an incredible...
That's what I hear.
It's an incredible mess.
I mean, I'll tell you this. If I felt that I could go and speak to people and do some good, even about one animal situation, you
right.
know, temples where the elephants are
yeah.
mistreated, if I would go. So.
Oh, well, I'm sure that that's true, because that's true everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, just like there are awful people, there are kind-hearted people,
yeah.
and you're passionate about it.
Truly.
Persuasive.
Truly.
So
well,
sure
I like to think so.
Yeah. Here's a question. You have said on your website you knew you wanted to be an actor from age 4.
Four.
What I still have no idea what I'm doing, where I'm going, what happens next. What is it like to have to know your whole life? Like, I just don't, I don't understand that.
It's a tremendous relief of a burden.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
It's
the last thing I actually wanted you to say.
Oh, I'm
sorry.
It was a tremendous struggle.
Yeah, that's
you know, while I saw my peers at school just loving the fact that they had all these choices and, you know, so on and so forth, I was saddled with me knowing what I wanted to do from the time I was four. No, I can't say that. I can't say that. Except for a brief and really tragic, disastrous, tragic flirtation with gymnastics, you know, when I was 12.
Yes.
It's always been acting. It's always been acting. I was a studio brat.
Yeah.
My father was a production designer. My aunt, an actress of some note. And I was just lucky that I happened to find it at such an early age. And even, you know, again, lucky, because, you know, I joke, but when I was in school, what do you want? Oh, a lawyer, an astronaut, you know, I want to go into veterinary medicine, a fireman, an Indian chief, whatever it is you want to be. It's like, nope. Single-minded and soul of purpose, so.
I have always wondered what it's like to just know that. It's been hard for me. I've had moments of knowing. Moments where I was at a crossroads and I said, the thing to do right here is to turn left.
Right.
And that's all I knew, and that's all I did. And I'm still surprised by where I am. And that happens to me, you know, every day. I'm like, I don't know how I got here.
Here's when it's tough.
It's amazing.
Here's when it becomes tough.
Yeah.
Because I have not trained for anything else. I think that there are many things I could have done. I could have possibly been a lawyer. I don't know that I've got the scientific mind to be a doctor, although I tend to be precise, you know, in movements and things like that. I think I would have been a wonderful chef, probably a great veterinarian. There's that science thing again. But there's nothing else I would have been happy doing. And that, to me, is the sign of a successful life. If you can wake up every day and say, I get to do what I love every single day, even if I don't happen to be doing it at that moment.
Sure.
I get to do what I love. So in that, I have had an extraordinarily successful life. But when those troughs, you know, when you're in the trough and you're not riding the crest, you kind of go, oh my gosh, well, I'm not trained to do anything else, so I really can't go left or right. I suppose I could give it up, but therein lies the problem, where I wouldn't be happy doing anything else. So I'd literally have to just have to march straight ahead. You don't really have the choice to diverge, you know.
Thank you so much for showing me the dark side of knowing the thing that I've never known.
That's the dark side.
That's good, because I'm the opposite.
Right.
Like, I am pretty good, you know, like a 70-80% at all kinds of things. Like, so many things.
Right.
You know. And to hear you say there are moments when you don't have a choice and you just have to keep going.
Right.
Anyway,
which is not to say, considering all the other things that I do in and with my life, that you can't have tangential loves. But I was very early that I picked out what's the coal that keeps, you know, that I have to keep shoveling into the oven. I went into the jar.
Okay,
I just.
Do that right now? What's the
yes, I did. Because you have. But I want you to come back to your question, but I just thought I would throw you off base. Okay. Adopt me outreach event outside Petco Saturday morning. That's what it says on the blue.
An Adopt Me outreach event outside of Petco Saturday morning.
Right? Yeah.
You're familiar with that as a location?
Yeah.
You may have passed those people.
I have a Petco close to me.
Would you like a line of dialogue, a pink paper, and then we can just create a little scene?
Oh, is that what we do?
And then you get a line of dialogue, and we have to justify that. Line of dialogue says, and would you like that in red or green?
Because the doggy vests... that you will be actually we're going to ask you to purchase when you do adopt your dog, because we're waiving all the fees.
Yes.
For we've already had the dog spayed and neutered, and we're waiving all of the, you know, city adoption fees. We're going to have your dog license, mm-hmm. but we do ask that you purchase a Christmas sweater for your dog. And so I would like to know if you'd like that. Would you like that in red or green?
Oh, Christmas sweater. Well, the problem is I'm one of those war on Christmas people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a sweater in a different color, is there anything other than red or green? Maybe some kind of polka dot, yellow, blue? I just need another color.
I'm so sorry. We have red or green because I just assumed that everyone in this neighborhood has adopted Jesus Christ as a personal Lord and Savior. But if you're Jewish...
Are these dogs all Christians?
Well, they've all been... The male dogs have certainly all been neutered, so you know you got to take up a little something, something. When you, I mean, if we're going in and taking the balls, you might as well just take the. But we have Kwanzaa colors.
I mean, I asked if they were Christians, and you said they've been neutered.
Well,
are you flirting with me?
I'm so surprised. Listen, take my dog, take me.
Take my dog. Okay. Well, that seems good.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, if they're neutered, then it kind of mutes the fact that they're Christians, because now they
can't reproduce, but we also take a little bit of the tip. Okay. So, yes. Okay, there you go.
Thank you.
For that. Okay. Now back to your question.
That's exactly what I'm supposed to do. Confuse and confound. I did another project.
Did you enjoy that scene? That was fun. Okay, good.
I directed a play in San Francisco a bunch of years ago, and it was a high point. I was quoted in the newspaper in big type saying, if no one leaves the theater either angry or confused, we haven't done our job.
Okay. I mean, was it Mabu Mimes?
It was actually a Zippy the Pinhead comic strip. Do you know that comic strip?
No.
It's an underground comic that was for 30 years super popular in the Village Voice and other places, and
you directed a play of it.
I adapted that character for the stage. It was a great experience. But
okay, back to your question.
I think that people have superpowers. Everyone, I suspect, it's a theory. And the superpower is a quality or an energy in a person's life that wants to just come through them. It's the thing that most naturally they do or sense or know without any effort at all. And I'm wondering if you know what that is for you.
I have two.
Yes.
Yeah. I have two. One that I discovered very early in life, and that is my ability to make people laugh. And so that became my, you know, that's simply my oxygen. That's the coating on the coal, if you will, because that's making people laugh. That's like oxygen. But I discovered a recent superpower just a few years ago, and that is my desire and ability to make people in situations where they are constantly crapped on feel very comfortable, very at ease, and it was all because of Marion Seldes. And my aunt knew Marion Seldes, and so we went backstage. And we were sitting waiting there, and after about 10 minutes, Marion comes flying down the staircase, like her feet aren't touching the ground. And she runs up to my Aunt Barbara, and she throws her arms around him, these delicate, pale Gainsborough arms with this Gainsborough face and this sort of, if you know who Marion Seldes is, she was not an attractive woman, but she was stunning. She played the caretaker's wife in that production with Catherine Zeta-Jones, that movie of The Haunted House on Haunted Hill, or The Haunting. And so she was in it from the beginning and the end, a very, very specific face. Not attractive, but gorgeous. I mean, a light around her. She was luminescent. And she looked at my aunt. She took my aunt's face in her hands and she said, Barbara, isn't it wonderful? I'm doing what I love. Isn't it? And this is a woman who was in her 70s and she'd won a Tony. She'd been doing what she'd loved for many, many years, and she was just focused on my Aunt Barbara. And I stood there looking kind of going, okay, well, no one's noticing me. What am I, chopped liver? I'm here too. You know, hi. And she used to go, Barbara, it's what? And she went on like that for about a good minute and a half. And finally, my aunt, sensing that there was, you know, an introduction to be made, she said, and this is my niece, Carolyn. She's an actress too. And Marion turned to me, and she looked at me, and the world dropped away into an abyss. And I looked into these dark, you know, almost hawkish eyes with these black beetle furrowed brows, into this porcelain face, and she went, yes, I can tell you're one of us. I know you're one of us. Isn't it wonderful? Aren't we blessed? Aren't we this and this? And I went, uh-huh, I love you. I love you. And I was just like, I went, what is this quality? What is this focus, this attention? And I then, many years later, had the opportunity to not understudy Marion, but be in the same play with Marion Seldes at the Mark Taper Forum, and watched her. And I thought, oh, this is a cultivatable quality. This is something that anyone can have if you simply put your mind to it. And so I adopted that as my superpower. And now, gas station attendants, retail clerks, supermarket cashiers, and especially when I am on set, on stage, when I am teaching, it is, you have my focus. You have my attention. I am listening, because so I realize that nobody pays attention to what anybody says.
Well, do you know what I mean?
People don't. It's me. And if you do, if you pay attention, it works on two levels.
Yeah.
You make the other person feel like you are a superhero.
Yes.
And they have encountered a superhero, and they can take that with them. Number two, on a higher, deeper level, you get something out of it, because you've just learned something. And as an actor, being, you know, the analogy is that we're the sponge. You get to learn. You get to just fill up, you know, you get to fill up your tank. And it's, so many people are so used to the third less important plus is that people just want to help you. You get more flies with sugar. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's a wonderful superpower. And you know what? And there are times that I fail.
Well.
There are times that I fail. There are times when I walk in, it's like, God damn it, just return it. But those are becoming increasingly less and less frequent.
But you recognize that you have a power.
Yeah.
And you know how to use it.
Sure.
And it feels to me like you have made a decision to use your superpower for good.
Not evil.
Rather than evil.
Yeah.
Because that's when you recognize that you have this power.
You can use it for evil. It can be, anything can be used for evil.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
I guess a third less superpower would be I can write a good letter. I can turn a good phrase, and you don't want to get a letter from Carolyn. You just don't.
Okay. All right.
You don't want to get a letter from
me. I'm going to take your word. unless
it's a really good letter.
Yeah. I really get a feeling for the power that you're talking about.
Good.
Because people are not seen right
now. No.
Especially with the social media and all that. I mean, you know, everyone is trying to be seen and understood.
Right.
And validated. And, I mean, that's, and if you can really see someone.
Yeah. And there's also the dual factors in this equation of 7 billion people on the planet, and social media cowardice. So,
social media cowardice.
In other words, people who want to hurt other people via social media.
Oh yeah, sure.
And then hide. So it makes the people who are on the receiving end want, you know, unless you've developed a truly, truly tough skin. And I remember my first days on Twitter, I didn't understand it. I didn't get it. And I, there were a couple of months where I was just sort of reacting. And then I went, oh, you don't know who I am.
Well, that's exactly.
You have no idea who I am. So it's like, I don't really need to talk to you.
I think that's what happens on social media, is people feel things. They believe that it's true, just
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm,
they feel it,
mm-hmm.
And they respond and don't care.
Right.
honestly.
Right.
We don't think about how anything might possibly be received.
But also, let's not forget that these are very often, more often than not, people who have been hurt, who have already been shattered. And how to, you know, two kinds of people in the world. Two kinds of people in the world. It's not the Irish and the non-Irish. It's not, you know, those who drink and those who don't.
Yeah.
It's people who elevate themselves by elevating others, and people who elevate themselves by destroying others. And most people in the world have, because it's so easy to destroy, because we're raised, you know, more often than not, we've been raised with hurt and guilt and prejudice and the slams and the slights and the scars that we carry. So, you know, misery and misery loves company. This is Comedy Death Star, man. So far, we've been very funny.
You've been raised.
Should I do another one of these?
No.
Okay, all right.
I was thinking about.
But see now, yeah, you lied.
No, I have.
Because it's not. I can't tell.
Well, you asked.
Okay.
You just did
all right.
It.
You're right.
You wouldn't need my permission. There's a joke. You said these two. There's a joke about this. There's
three kinds
of people in the world. Those who are good at math and those who aren't.
Huh? I get it. That's funny.
All that stuff, yes. When I started to be an improviser, I was fascinated by status and the study of status, because it is what you said. If you want to raise yourself by lowering other people or raising yourself, which is the activity of your status relationship with other people, happens all the time. And for most people, it happens unconsciously, right? There are people who are compulsive, low-status players who duck all the time so that they can avoid being hit or shit on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other people who compulsively raise themselves and are competitive on everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, both of those have their problems.
Sure.
But status is a great way to look at stuff.
Sure.
Like that.
Yeah.
I have another question, though.
Okay.
You brought up something important.
Competition's interesting. That's an interesting. It's an interesting topic, but we can get back to that. Okay.
The dark side.
The dark side.
I asked about your superpower. That's awesome.
Yes.
I have used in my coaching work.
It's all about you, Denzel. It's all about you. What's going on?
It's my show.
Yeah, but
you're the guest.
Still, okay.
I'm gonna ask a question about you.
Okay.
And about your shadow, the dark parts of you. The guy has a book called Taming Your Gremlin, where his name is Richard Carson, and he says those voices that say awful things to us in our heads, we mostly just push them away. What if we listened closely to them, really listened, and said, who is this person that's speaking to me, and created creatures so that you could get more in touch with those labeled negative voices that come at you and work with them. And so I'm curious about, the doubts, not the content necessarily, the doubts you have, but what are those voices that speak to you? Do you have any sense of what kind of creatures they are or what they, what do they tell you?
Yeah, I do. And I illustrated them verbally in my Pandora series, because the Pandora series is about me. It's about three little girls, each one of whom carries within herself traits of the authoress. Together, they form the every girl, because each one of them also has universal traits. And it's what they come up against that are the demons that, I'm being general, that not just I had to go through. It was very cathartic writing it, because I believe and I know that the scars, the insults, the slights that we experience, especially during our formative years, you know, your tweens into your teens, and if those are not addressed and healed, and nobody ever addresses and heals them, because we always want to think, you know, we're tougher than that, or get over it, or cry it out, or hug it out, Well, a lot of times they do need to be addressed. Most of the time they need to be addressed.
Yeah.
All the time.
Young would sit and agree with you.
Yes.
Freud would agree. Yeah.
Everybody would
Freud
agree with me.
Yeah.
So a lot of what these girls come up against in terms of their quest to do what they need to do and you know, hopefully save the world, are things that I came up against. So those are the gremlins. Older, you know, Carolyn today gremlins. Carolyn's gremlins today. Wow.
You wrote a character breakdown.
A character of my fear gremlin.
Yeah, what kind of person?
I gotta tell you, this is a tough one, and I don't know if I've. Okay, it would be the gremlin of. It would be the gremlin of I don't know. And let me sort of describe the context of the gremlin, and then maybe we can paint a picture of it.
Sure.
Because of the life that was chosen for me, the life I chose at the age of four.
Yeah.
But I firmly believe was chosen for
me.
It's the gypsy lifestyle, and I still haven't hit the success that I think I'm going to hit. I have had 10 years of tremendous success. But there's more to come. But we can't. But within that are there's it's a crest, a big, big crest. But then there are troughs.
Yes.
There are peaks and valleys. And in the trough, it is my gremlin might also be the I'm exhausted gremlin, because it can for the first few weeks, months, days when you've left a job and you don't necessarily have anything on the horizon, but you're going out and you're auditioning, you know, you're auditioning. It's easy to say, you know what? I'm good. My name is out there. I've got money in the bank. I've got a reputation. People enjoy working with me, et cetera, et cetera. But as the time goes on and, you know, for whatever reason, you're not working, it becomes, it takes a little bit more, you know, as the weeks pass to keep that everything's going to be great. To behave as if everything's going to be great. And people say, oh, Carolyn, you work all the time. It's like, yeah, no, I don't. I don't work all the time.
Yeah, we see you all
and
the
I,
time.
See me all the time, but I don't work all the time. And fortunately, I have a lot of other things that I do, a trapeze, and I have animals and this kind of thing. But working, the actual being on stage or being in front of a camera, that thing that is the coal for the train, the box can be a little empty sometimes. So it becomes more arduous to get up every morning and put that brave face on. So it would be the exhaustion gremlin. So let's say my gremlin would be simply fatigued all the time. There would be somebody who would be like one of the dolly clocks slumped over a chair. So that would be one gremlin. The other gremlin,
I like that. So it's kind of melting and slumped.
Melting and slumped. Yes,
no
exactly. There is
body tone, no energy.
There are no bones.
There
are no bones. It's just a giant mass of tire. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's clear.
Yeah,
and the I don't know one.
The I don't know one would be that every once in a while you kind of go, Well, I don't know when I'm going to work again. I know I will work again, but I don't know when I'm going to work again. So the I don't know one is a giant, big, hairy, moldy question mark. on two legs.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
There you go. Those
giant, hairy, moldy question mark on two legs.
Yeah. Green.
Yeah,
green, you know, that sort of penicillin mold green.
Mm-hmm. And green is also the color of envy.
It's all, but it's also the color of money.
Yeah, money and envy.
No,
it's coming together totally.
Envy. I don't have a tendency to. I'm not plagued by a lot of envy.
That's not you.
No,
that doesn't seem like you.
No.
All right, I have some other questions.
Okay.
How are we doing so far?
This is first one. How do you think we're doing?
It's great.
I think it's rolling right along, merrily.
Our audience is entertained and engaged, and they're listening.
I hope so. I hope they're not, going off to make a sandwich.
Well, a few people pulled over so they could really focus.
Really? You think
people,
so?
Yeah,
oh, good.
Yeah,
I'm so glad.
And, you know, they're like, this interview is great. I love Carolyn. I think I'm just going to pull over here in the Target parking lot for the last 10 minutes of the show because
okay.
I don't want to miss anything.
All right.
I'm reasonably confident.
I'm going into the tilt jar. Oh, look, and I pulled out a pink and a blue. Which one do I read first?
It's up to you.
Up to you, okay.
You're the guest.
The blue is...
It's our location.
11:56 p.m. I gotta lower my voice for this. It's 11:56 p.m. at the Slowdown Club. And slow is written S-L-O-E, like the gin.
11:56 p.m. the Slowdown Club.
The Slowdown Club.
A lot of dialogue. Yes.
Is... Just hold your breath, and it'll all be over in a minute or three. See, because what I'm telling you is, this whole Y2K thing, the world is not going to explode. What, we got 3-4 minutes? It's 11:56, man. New Year's Eve. Just trust me.
It's all going to be
It's
okay.
all going to be fine. It's just going to be fine. The lights may flicker a little bit, but, you know, buy this girl another drink and just hang on. I'm also a licensed therapist.
I have been concerned about the Y2K thing.
Yeah. See?
You seem to really get it.
I do get it. I understand.
In a way that most people don't.
I understand. Well, listen, you know, this isn't the, by the way, you know, this isn't our first time here. We have many, many lifetimes, so this whole Y2K thing, it's happened before. It's actually 2016, and the Y2K thing is happening again.
Now, here's a question. As a child, you had an imaginary friend. Your imaginary friend also had an imaginary friend. Where are they now?
One's in Folsom.
Prison.
But the charges were trumped up. And, that's my imaginary friend. And, her imaginary friend, has now become someone else in Folsom's imaginary bitch.
Where is Folsom?
Folsom?
I don't know. I've heard about it. It's famous, right? Johnny Cash?
We have to ask Johnny Cash. I think it's somewhere in the Midwest. But I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. Yeah.
Do we know why either your imaginary friend or her imaginary friend are in Folsom?
They were trumped up on my imaginary friend was trumped up on some charges. She fell in with the wrong crowd. She was the driver for a deal gone wrong, and some people were killed. She was the only one, and everyone dumped it on her. Everyone pinned it on her. She was the only one that actually didn't have a gun. She wasn't armed. She didn't kill anybody. She just was in the wrong place. She knew what she was doing, but she was the driver of the getaway car, and she got caught. And everyone said that she was the mastermind. So, you know,
wow.
It's kind of an Orange is the New Black sort of thing. And and her imaginary friend is now shacking up with Crazy Eyes.
Crazy Eyes.
Yeah.
All right. I think I like that.
Because Crazy Eyes can actually see my imaginary friend's imaginary friend.
That makes perfect sense to me. Clowns.
You.
Funny, scary, friendly. What are they?
Depends. Ringling Brothers clowns. You're straight. You know the clowns from which the caricatures are taken. Scary, and I don't find particularly funny. French clowns, the Cirque du Soleil clowns. Hilarious. Can be hilarious.
So it depends on the clown.
If there's wit. The type of audience interaction, the degree of the mime, the pantomime that the clown is doing, how they are riffing and sort of, you know, joking with the audience, taking off on the audience, and if nobody gets hurt, yeah. But a good and an intelligent clown, a clown that that speaks to perhaps, you know, brings in cultural modern day references, but yet plays on universal themes. You know, a good David Shiner, one of the great Bill Irwin, one of the greats.
Any clowns are sometimes really misunderstood. I mean, people have issues with clowns. I mean, do you have any thoughts about why that is?
Because they're supposed to make us laugh, and you know, Stephen King did a great job with the clown in It, clown doll in Poltergeist. When clowns are shown for the very first time to be not just not funny but fatal and demonic. I mean, whoever had the idea to paint a, you know, to envision a clown as a source of fear, that tapped into the consciousness, because it's unexpected. Clowns are supposed to be funny and friendly, you know, and when they're not, that can really mess a little kid up.
Yeah.
Also, clown frescoes are just. In the Pandora books, Hades, the god of the underworld. He has a certain set of rooms, a set of apartments on Mount Olympus, but no one ever wants to go down there. That's where the 12 Olympians live. You know, Zeus and everyone lives up there, but no one ever wants.
You can't get Thai food or anything delivered.
You can't get good takeout unless you know, vacuum sealed.
Yeah,
FedEx does not deliver to the top.
Amazon, drones,
but in addition, you're right. In addition to ruling the underworld, when Hades does visit Olympus, he has a personal set of apartments, but no one ever wants to go there because of, you know, the walls of blood and the tables made of human teeth and all these kinds of things. But the real horrors are his pressed flower scrapbooks and the clown frescoes. Yeah. That's what Hades collects, in as far as I'm concerned. Those are pressed flower scrapbooks and clown frescoes. He has a collection of clown frescoes, and those are the really horrible things.
And those are in your books.
Yeah, that's what I read.
Wow, that's.
I did an amazing description of Hades' apartments with, you know, the walls of blood and the walls of suffering and the crying and the reverberating floors and the souls and wailing. But the reason that nobody ever really wants to go there is because they would be forced to look at his pressed flower scrapbooks and the clown frescoes.
And what are those? What are the clowns to Hades? He is a
he loves them.
Of the underworld. Right?
Yes, exactly.
He's the master of death.
He's
the ruler of the underworld.
He's the ruler of the underworld. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. No. I mean, what's the connection? Because you might think that this is a guy that does not have a sense of humor. That is, you know,
it just shows that he with the pressed flower scrapbooks that he is a little bit sentimental, and he's got an even more bizarre side because he collects clown frescoes.
No, it makes perfect sense to me that would be there.
Yeah, but again, the other gods, like we as humans, are horrified. They don't want to have to look at the pressed flower scrapbooks, and they don't want to have to look at the clown frescoes because they're terrified. Well,
that
you,
makes
but
me
but
laugh.
You, but you that, have you've you're a clown.
I'm a scary clown.
You're a scary clown.
I'm a scary offensive clown.
Makeup?
Yeah, I have some creatures. There's one of my creatures, a couple of my creatures, startle people and occasionally make kids cry before I do anything.
And you enjoy that?
I think that's part of their education on a certain level. I mean, I think it's real. Clowns.
Is that telling people that the things that look the most fun and interesting are often the most deadly?
No, I don't think that's
buyer beware.
Message. I think I think what comedy is, first of all, what a clown is, what a comedian is a creature that sucks at things. Clowns are not competent creatures. They they fail, they fall down, they whack people in the head. Whatever they try to do, they do not succeed. And that is an energy of the universe, and it is part of being uniquely human, you know, that we fail constantly. I mean, animals do the thing that they do. We never say, oh, that tiger. I mean, they don't have that experience that we do in the same way. So I think that's what they embody. And, but then they don't give up. I mean, you really can't keep a good clown down. every time they fall down, they get back up again.
Right.
And I think on a certain level, that is a terrifying quality, because they're indestructible and they're totally incompetent. And I think that combination creates a darkness and opens the open. I think they're agents of destruction.
But physically,
yes,
they can be very benign. They can be very fun to look at. They are bright colors, and they've got big noses, and they're funny.
Sure.
And they can have the best of intentions. They have the best hearts.
Absolutely.
But scary clowns do not.
Well, if you're trying to be a scary clown, I think that misses the point.
Okay.
So that's not
okay.
That's
but then,
not what
but,
I do.
But the clown that comes out and frightens children right off the bat, what does he look like?
Well, this particular creature.
Clowns are hopeful, is what you're saying. Clowns are.
Yeah, they are hopeful.
Yeah. Okay.
They are hopeful.
Okay.
It's a clown costume.
It's a clown costume, but it frightens kids.
Well.
Is it supposed to frighten kids?
No, it's not. That's not the goal, right? It's you play a creature that is alive in the world and has a life of his own or her own. One of these creatures has fallen off of his bicycle. And, I have like a tweed suit and a bow tie and the cap I usually wear. And my face is completely messed up. And one of my lenses of my eyeglasses is smashed, right? I bought some and did that. And the game you play is that as he walks around, he is always like a hair away from falling down. And never quite fall. So he's constantly lurching and staggering and stumbling. And, and his face is all messed up and bloody in his eyes.
Okay. Wait a minute. Hang on. His face is all bloody.
Yeah.
That's the scary thing.
Or a little bloody, a little...
No. If it's not your face, perhaps even clown white, the glass can be smashed, but... Your teeth are filed to a chisel points. Your face is bloody. Okay, that's the scary thing. Not that you're falling down and trying. It's that you have, obviously, little kids can say, anyone can say, you've experienced pain.
Yeah.
You've experienced some massive amounts of pain. Pain is not fun for children. Pain's not fun for anybody. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, now I get why they cry. But if you were just you and you were... trying and you didn't have all the blood on your face, then the lesson wouldn't be as profound.
Well,
but the kids wouldn't scream.
Yeah, that's not a, like, I don't take that to a kid's party and say, hey, I'm a kid party clown.
No.
And here I am.
No, but where would you perform something like that?
He's out on the street a lot.
Is he?
Well, Halloween or certain events and parties and things, and even in the daytime. As this guy lurches and you're not sure if he, if he's pretending or really going to fall on you, people get freaked out. Yeah. So, but I, I have other characters that, like the first time I went to clown school, I did not know why I was there. I had a certain experience, something in my life cracked open, and these costumes and characters started to come out, and I didn't know who they were. I just knew that I would see the clothing, and I would put it on, and I would make a face for myself, and that was a... But I didn't know how to inhabit this, so I said, I have to go to clown school. And the first time I went, you don't actively create a creature. You improvise, and one comes to life.
Oh, yeah.
And it's you.
Oh, yeah.
And right away, I recognized that my clown thought he was smarter and prettier than all the other clowns. And I immediately recognized that there was a quality of me that thought that. And I had never seen it before. And I was embarrassed about that part of me. And I didn't want to claim that part of me. And I certainly didn't want to exaggerate it to grotesqueness, which is the job. And I hated my creature. I hated him. I did not want to be him. It was a classic, this is my shadow come to life. And I just am seeing it for the first time at age 40-something, and I don't want it. And I was freaked out. The end of the weekend, I said to the teacher, thank you and fuck you. And he's an Italian guy. He laughed. He said, you'll be back. you know, and I kept doing that work because it freaked me out so much.
Well, you had to face it.
Yeah, that I but that guy is, you know, mean. You know, he's a white-faced clown. He puts all the other clowns down. He insults people. He tells them they suck. He thinks he's better in every way. You know, but that's funny.
Have you ever read any de Sade? Mm-hmm. Anything by the Marquis de Sade?
I've read it, maybe.
They're very tough.
Yeah,
they're exceptionally, exceptionally tough.
Small parts.
But
really.
One of the things that de Sade, in the preamble to, you know, the complete collected works of the Marquis de Sade, one of the things that he talks about is the fact that everyone has everything. We are born, no one is born with simply pure, good, wonderful, angelic thoughts. We all have them all the time. And it is in recognizing them, facing them, and getting to know their names and dealing with them that we can ultimately, you know, put them on the shelf and put them in the compartment where they are supposed to be, so that we don't think that, you know what, any thought I have, if it's bad, it's sinful, according to, you know, the great Mother Church or this and this. So instead of, I can't take it out here, I have to go home and kick the dog. And once we understand that we've got these capacities, that we have all of this inside of us, then we can start to actually live truly full lives. So you were sort of, you know,
yeah.
I remember...
Well, that's what he was doing, sorry. So what he was doing was trying to
bring
in touch with, claim, own, and purge parts of his shadow.
Well, purge, but also make it societally acceptable for other people to claim, own, and purge.
To bring it into the light.
Of course.
Because when things are repressed,
they fester. They fester. I'll never forget when I was at university. One of my professors one day, we were talking about various forms of comedy, and she pointed to me and she goes, "Now look at Carolyn. Carolyn is a quintessential example of the grotesque." And I went, "Huh?
Excuse me.
What? I don't get what?" And and I went home and I looked up the word grotesque, because I only thought it was what I and it said, you know, yes, it's exaggerated and frightful, blah, blah, blah. And I came back to school the next day and I went, "How could you say that about me?" And she went, No. "When I talk about grotesque in terms of comedy, I'm talking about Phyllis Diller and Lucille Ball and Vivian Vance and, you know, Milton Berle." And then I went, "Oh." Okay, she said, "People who are willing to go to the mat for comedy, to make the funny faces, to fall down, to this and this and this, to do whatever it takes to make people laugh. Because as far as I'm concerned, laughter is healing. Laughter is holy and healing." And I went, "Oh, well, then yes, you're right. I am grotesque.
Then that's me.
Then I am grotesque." And so I sort of had to embrace those grotesque elements of myself.
Yeah.
Early, you know, early in my career.
That sounds useful.
Yeah, incredibly useful. Incredibly useful. You look like you're packing up. Are we packing up?
No.
Oh, good. Okay.
No.
Oh, good.
We just got here.
Okay, good. Okay, fine.
We've been talking for 6 minutes.
That's right. We have. Of course, it's the Y2K, you know,
Y2K,
it's the Y2K, many, many lives, many masters, 2016 syndrome.
Yeah, those people all do go to the mat for comedy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And whatever they get wrong, they keep going. They get out.
Fail big. If you're going to fail, fail big, and most of the time people don't notice. That's a great lesson, comedy, drama, life. Most of the time, people don't. If you fail, fail big. And most of the time, your audience won't know.
Well, and we root for you.
Of course.
When you commit fully and you fall on your face and you get up, we love it. We cheer for you. Yes, go Carol.
Right, but those who are not channeling their inner clown, that lesson works for them as well. If you're going to fail, man, own it. Fail big or go home. Fail big or take the consequences. Because if you fail big, very often there aren't any consequences. Because people sometimes there's a tremendous success, a lesson learned, and your audience doesn't know.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I had a boss once who we were in a conference call, and everybody was trying to get the work done, and he, wherever he was from, calling in, kept saying the dumbest things ever, and he did it for an hour, And then, you know, we finished, and I got off the phone, and I called him up, and I said, Nigel, what's going on with you today? And he said, oh, I took it as my job to go out of bounds. He said, you guys have all been doing great work. You're all very competent. I have total faith in you. You didn't need me to add value to the good work that's being done. You guys got it. My job was to make outlandish statements and find out where the edges really are.
That's genius.
And I never forgot that.
That's genius.
There's a value in being willing to go too far.
Of course.
Right? Clowns go too far.
It's true. It's true. And comedians.
Yeah, that says clowns.
Clowns, comedians, and magicians go too far.
Yeah.
But they are so incredible. It's not just necessary. They're mandatory for the world. They're mandatory. Because how do we determine where our boundaries are? How do we how does anything ever get done, solved, invented, thought about, if it's not for the people who push the boundaries? And that includes science.
Yep.
You know, that. But in terms of the universality of the human experience, clowns, comedians, and magicians.
Yeah. No, you're right. They go too far. But then back to the superpower and this, you know, whether you're... as a performer, if you do that in service,
You have to. Well, that's
it's not about me.
No. Performing is in service. Actually, to be honest, I will say this: the best performers, the best performers, the least worthy performers are in service to themselves.
Correct.
The best performers are in service to others, and then there's a third level. Where, and it's just, you know, the difference between being in service, the bad performers in service of, who have totally, you know, absolutely narcissistic, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll goals. And then there's a light years of difference between those who are in service to others. But then just slightly above that. I mean, like, you know, you can see it, you can touch it. Where you are actually, you've come back full circle and you are in service to yourself. In the best possible way, you are gleaning so much from what you are doing. You are expanding yourself. You understand fully that the audience is getting, and then you have to let that go because they're going to get what they're going to get. You can't control that. You can only control what you're putting out, but you have to be fully in control of what you are putting out. And, you know, you've got to stand on the stage and draw the chalk circle and claim lightning to strike and then be willing to be electrified. Not just have the audience be electrified by the magic that you're dishing out, you know, the education and entertainment, but then you have to be willing to be electrified as well. So it's in service to you, and that's where it becomes holy.
And so when you say that, there's a giving up. You're fully giving
mm-hmm.
yourself over,
mm-hmm.
giving yourself up to.
Mm-hmm. You've done the work, and now you let it go. And then, you know, I feel like I have to add this because what we're talking about can be construed as very lofty, but it's like, you know, and then you have to give yourself permission, because you will, to fail. Because we're in corporeal form, because we ain't, nobody's a bodhisattva. I've only met two of them in my life. And one was in Thailand, and she works with elephants. And
you know, we will fail.
We will fail. We will fail. But we can't beat ourselves up too much. We just can't do it. And understand that we will.
Well, I think in the scenario that you've just outlined, I didn't hear anything there about the goal being to get something perfect.
No.
Right?
No.
The goal is to connect and to communicate.
Right.
Right? Which is both receiving and sending. And to touch people.
Mm-hmm.
And so if those are the goals, then, you know,
then
you
yes.
succeed or fail, I mean, that
right.
it doesn't matter. That's not the point.
I just think, I think that everyone's going to have off days.
Yeah, well.
Everyone's going to have off days. Yeah. And the goal is to sort of make them, you know, as rare as possible. One of the goals,
yeah. I fall down a lot.
Oh, boy. Me too. I think that's one of the reasons why I trapeze, because I'm always falling.
Yeah, tell me about that. That's something new for you, right?
No, it's actually been about 15 years.
15 years.
Okay. With a 5 year, between years 1 and 5, and years, you know, 5 and 10, and there was a 5 years that I sat on my ass. Years 5 through 10, I sat on my ass and wrote books.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now you're back to flying.
And now I'm back to flying through the air and falling a lot.
Falling.
And falling is sometimes the most glorious part.
How so?
Because you never know precisely how you're going to land in the net. And what I always try and do is land in the net with my eyes open and just taking in the entire blue vastness. And then, in come the trees. You know, it's the farther you fall, in come the trees, and then in comes, you know, the everything else, all the other equipment in the yard. And but it's that free fall plummeting. You know there's a net underneath you, but it's when you're just being held by spirit. You're just being, you know. That and throwing yourself up. It's the throwing yourself up when you don't have a safety harness on.
Yeah.
You know there's always a net. That's great. But when you're able to take a particular trick out of lines without a safety harness, without having anybody in and pull you and save your ass, when you're able to take that and the moment you let go, before you catch, it's that divine moment.
Yeah.
It's not falling out of a plane, right, where you're just continually plummeting, but it's that throwing yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of embracing all possibility, and then knowing that you're safe when you fall.
That's fantastic. I love the image of you falling and making sure that you have your eyes open.
Mm-hmm.
And that you're as open to everything that's happening
right
in that moment,
mm-hmm,
as possible. That I totally understand. That's fantastic.
You got to come try it.
I would like to try it.
Sure.
I mean, you know, it's a little daunting, but that's why.
I always say, if you can climb up 25 feet and throw yourself in the air, you can do anything.
You can do anything. I have my own moment like that.
Yeah.
And the moment I'm cueing into is this moment when your whole body wants to go into the fight or flight mode, and like chemically it happens. And
your hypothalamus is on red alert.
Your lizard brain goes bam.
Yep.
And at that moment, you can also have an other part of you stay open, aware, conscious,
mm-hmm,
happy, breathe, take it. Right? I mean, that moment of fear, to open our field of perception.
You're talking about most of my marriages. actually, I would have said most of my relationships. I've only had one marriage. It's like you're talking about most of them. It's fight or flight. No, let's stay here. Oh, we've stayed too long. Okay, good.
But now we found something that we really have in common.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Now I'm still thinking about using all of your relationships and marriage as a way to fuck yourself up. I'm just going to say that...
It's the flight or fight.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, and believe me, more often than not, my hypothalamus betrayed me. When I should have run, I stayed and fought, went to the mat. It's like, okay, I should have left. I've learned that lesson.
What's the lesson?
The lesson is when you just know that it's that, forgive the analogy, that the baby is dead. You stop rocking. You just stop rocking the baby. If making the mistake is equivalent to sticking your hand in the badger cage or over an open flame, and you don't get it, and you keep having to, then it is a mistake that you keep having to relive this mistake over again. It's like, you know, after a while, you gotta get it. But none of your, marriages, obviously, were sticking your hand over an open flame.
Not literally.
Not literally.
No.
Do you know what I mean? But it's like, at a certain point, I mean, I was in something, which lasted a long time, and then I was just in something that I went, oh, the church is playing the same tune on its bells. These are the same, very same bells that are ringing. Red alert, run, don't walk. And I'm very, it's like, okay, short period of time.
I figured it out.
And staying any longer would have been a mistake. So it neither of them were mistakes, but staying longer once you have the information, you know what?
And you grew.
You grew. Yeah, absolutely. That's why we're here.
I don't believe in the mistakes like, you know, oh gosh, I needed to learn something.
Of course.
And so,
of course.
You know, I'm getting it.
Of course.
All right. We should probably wrap it up.
Okay.
Probably.
All right.
If you're so popular, you have other life, I'm sure, things to do, people to know.
Places to go, people to see, people to do.
But I would like to thank you.
My pleasure.
Norman Hennessy, for being on the show. I had some other great questions to ask, but you know, you're going to have to come back.
I would be happy to, because I actually do have a bit of a time crunch right now, but we'll talk about comedy and animals and fun things, because we didn't really get into animals, but we have to be continued.
And I would love to bake. I thought about this last night.
I'm the queen of shortbread. I make many, many different kinds. I have shortbread varietals.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, we'll try to figure out a way that we can bake or cook together.
Sure.
I'd love to do that. That's great with friends. I would like to thank our guest, Carolyn Hennessy, star of Stage, Screen, Library, Zoo,
you bet.
And Circus Tent. Coming in this week. Thanks also to our producer and engineer, Dylan Vigil, and Dean Mermel, who wrote our theme music. If you'd like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, you can email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. You have been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio, right here in Hollywood, USA. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thanks for listening, and we will be back next week.